And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.
I love that riff. Great show, and there was a pitch for a support of community media from their editor, Jim Narakis. And there reminds me to check about the upcoming attempt to raise funds for WEFT. And reading some of the material is something I've not seen before. We have a pledge, a matching donation. All donations up to $10,000 will be matched. I'm not asking you to call now because it starts Wednesday, but you can call anytime or go online. But I guess the pledge period would be the time to qualify for that match. That's exciting. I've never heard of that anymore. We've had a in-kind donation of somebody buying a board for WEFT. I guess it was one of the BOD members, to not confuse you with the board bought a board. Somebody on the board bought a board. I'm happy to hear that. We've been having some troubles audio-wise. I hope we don't have any glitches today because, I want you to be able to listen comfortably. Yeah, I'm already 2 minutes in, and I've got more than I can possibly get on, as usual. Wanted to say Center for Constitutional Rights is where some alumni of that are now doing the show Law and Disorder that I go to, and they have some good stuff I thought about putting on, but I found out that Iranian activist scholar Behrouz Ghamari Tabrizi, who was on Democracy Now! And was in town a week ago Thursday, gave a brilliant talk that he didn't want recorded because can be taken out of context, but he did do a hour-long interview on the Ralph Nader Hour, Ralph Nader Radio Hour. Yeah, he's got a good crew of support, and he's still cogent as ever. I know there's some people that still blame him for 2000, but that's totally misinformed. The election was actually won if you'd counted all the votes, and according to Greg Palast, and demonstrably so, there was a purposefully fallacious felon list that was used to disqualify voters of Latino and African-American origin who would have most likely swung Democrat. And it was in the thousands. I think 30, 40,000 people were disqualified. Might even be more. It was reported when he was working for the BBC, but didn't get much attention here. It was consciously done by Kathleen Turner and Jeb Bush, one of the Bush siblings. All right, well, I know there's still people that discredit Ralph Nader for anything because of that, and it just ain't true. So we're going to get to that. I'm also going to go back and play a web exclusive by Michael Hudson. It's part two of an interview that was conducted a bit ago, but has such a grand title. That, now why did that happen? Who knows? War on Iran is part of the U.S. plan for global domination, economist Michael Hudson. He had a counterpunch article. The U.S.-Israeli attack was to prevent peace, not to advance it. Not a headline you'll see in the Times. I don't think they have an op-ed that even approaches that. The other thing I have is a little short segment with Silverstein. He does a website called Tikkun Olam. The project of recreating the world is kind of what the gist of the Hebrew translation is. He's unabashedly anti-Zionist Jew. And he mentions a film, and I have been trying to find out about it at Sundance, apparently this year, about a bomb attack back in the days when he was with New Jewish Agenda in L.A. So it's all very complicated, and I haven't been able to find the name of the film that he references. So, yeah, I'll be looking for that through this show. But I am seeing that Umi Abu Jamal actually had a commentary that I didn't know about. It's a little bit of a retrospective of his political education back in Philly. So I think I'm going to go to that straight away here. Well, maybe I'll play this underwriting announcement first. Is it voiced?
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by the listeners of WEFT and That's the Cut Barbershop. Located in Mahomet, That's the Cut is a retro barbershop offering professional haircuts and shaves. That's the Cut Barbershop, 601 East Main Street in Mahomet, 217-855-9673, and on Facebook or the Booksy app. That's the Cut Barbershop.
Okay, if you have a club or a group that has an event coming up and you want to mention, we thank all of the varied underwriters. Let's get to Umi Abu Jamal. I like to play him when I can. We are in the incarceral nation, after all.
I'm reminded of being a young guy, a teenager. And I was fascinated with books, but I couldn't afford many of them because they were so expensive. So I would go into Robin's bookstore in Center City. And I would walk in there and read to my heart's content. I really didn't have intention to buy many books. And again, I couldn't afford them. But I remember picking up a book called The Wretched of the Earth by Franz Fanon, a strange name like that. And I turned it around, and it talked about the book being considered, it was either the handbook of the Black Revolution or the Bible of the Black Revolution. I'm not sure which, but having read that on the back cover, I was in. I was sold. I mean, this is a book not only that I was required to read as a young member of the Black Panther Party, but I wanted to read it, and I wanted to devour it. If I could have eaten it, I would have done it. It was a wonderful and thrilling experience. And that was its first English translation. I think that its second translation leaves something to be desired. I think both translations are difficult to really capture the remarkable brilliance of a guy like Franz Fanon. But the first edition, because that's the one that really rings in memory and in mind, had a bit of beauty in it and a bit of poetry in it that does not survive to the present. But we remember. Reading when you're a teenager will ring in your brain as long as you live. With love, not fear, this is Mumia Abu Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
And there are quite a few and varied commentaries from people on the inside there. I think he is fluent in French. He has pretty good spoken French. I've heard him speak a couple of times, and I guess he probably can read pretty well, so he can discern that difference. I found it hard to read. I think I gave up at some point. It's on my list. All right. Like I say, we're moving along breakneck speed here. So I will certainly be excerpting Behrouz Ghamari's Tabrizi's talk from our interview at the Ralph Nader Radio Hour, and probably present the remainder tomorrow. You can find it all the local podcasts. And again, he was on campus and gave a really incredible talk. But I guess I'm going to go to the Michael Hudson piece first. This sort of hearkening back to when Amy Goodman had a Breaking the Sound Barrier essay regularly. She says it's on a hiatus now. She's getting ready for a big party on, got snowed out when it was first scheduled with a surprise guest. Michael Hudson did an interview March 4th. This is part two that wasn't aired here on WEFT. And as I mentioned, he also has a piece, sort of complimentary piece on UNZ Review, Michael Hudson Archive, thinking about the unthinkable, Iran's grand plan to end U.S. presence in the Middle East on March 9th. I haven't totally dissected that yet. So, but this is the other side, what the U.S. is perhaps really thinking, not about peace, but pieces of territory, perhaps, pieces of the oil wealth.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We're continuing our conversation with economist Michael Hudson. His most recent article for Counterpunch is headlined, "The U.S.-Israeli Attack Was to Prevent Peace, Not to Advance It." Michael Hudson is a financial analyst and president of the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trends, distinguished research professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Juan, why don't you begin part two?
I wanted to ask you, in our earlier conversation, you mentioned that this that the United States' attack on Iran is really about controlling world oil supplies more than the internal dynamics or the threat of Iran against the U.S. And you mentioned the Arab oil boycott of the 1970s. But there's been a major shift, obviously, since that period of time. Back then, the United States was highly dependent on the Middle East for its oil. Today, it's essentially, this country is essentially self-sufficient in terms of its production of oil, so that there is really no direct need for the U.S. economy of oil. But as you mentioned, it is controlling the supply of the Middle East is a way, really, of controlling other countries. I mean, obviously, India, China depend largely on Mideast oil for their oil supply. And of course, natural gas from Qatar flows to those countries as well as to Europe. Could you elaborate a little more about how you believe this is actually a way to put the stranglehold on other countries in the world?
Well, you can see the result of what happened when the United States blocked Europe from buying Russian oil and gas after Russia's special military operation in February 2022. The German chemical industry was greatly downsized. The glass industry that runs on gas heating ended. Germany moved into a recession and essentially remains in recession. And with the war in Iran yesterday, the German price of oil jumped over 20%. And this is breaking the European budgets, basically, because unless the government gives special subsidies to consumers to heat their homes and light their homes, something has to give. The government has a choice, either cut back its social spending in order to support the military budget that's supported by Starmer in England, Macron in France, and Merz in Germany, or move into recession. So getting back, you mentioned the U.S. being self-sufficient in oil. This is very important because while oil prices are going up for the rest of the world and they're in an economic squeeze, the United States isn't. The rise in world oil prices is a windfall for the United States domestic oil companies. and gas companies. They're making a killing on the United States. So this, the United States balance of payments is in very good terms, but this is creating a crisis that I think is unanticipated by the U.S. government. As oil prices go up, especially for global South countries, which you didn't mention, how are the countries of Africa and South America going to be able to pay for the increase in oil prices that they have and pay the foreign debts that are falling due? They're already in a squeeze of the debts falling due to U.S. dollar bondholders, stockholders, banks, and the International Monetary Fund. Something has to give. So these countries are now facing a choice. Are they? Who's going to come first? Are they going to pay the bondholders at the cost of imposing domestic austerity, ending up looking like Germany is looking today? Or are they going to say, because of the U.S. attack on Iran that's caused the oil price increase, we can't afford to pay the dollar debt. So we're banding together and calling for a moratorium on debt payments. This is going to completely disrupt financial markets if the blockage of the Hormuz Straits continues for more than a few months. You may be surprised at how little the price of oil has gone up already. Well, it's gone up 10%. That's a lot, but it's not really shocking. The United States and other countries are going to be releasing their oil reserves in order to keep down international prices, at least until the elections, and especially to keep down prices in the United States, in order for Trump to say, well, I'm not creating inflation and squeezing the budgets of homeowners and voters because we're making sure that we're stabilizing things. The war will be over very quickly. And Trump continues to say it's going to be over in 4 weeks, when he is scheduled, by no coincidence, to go to China. And I received notes from China today saying that this is very important. It's so important that China is, they were going to publish a third edition of my book, Superimperialism, which was basically the guide for the Defense Department's move with OPEC way back in 1974. China wants to sort of keep everything very quiet so it can essentially give the ultimatum to Trump, saying, if you try to block oil trade to us, if you block us, the Chinese, from buying Russian tankers, if you continue to seize Russian tankers, if you continue to block Venezuela's oil to us and Iran's oil to us, then we're going to increase, just stop all the exports of essential materials to you. And if you continue to support the Taiwanese independence and sell them arms, we're also going to stop that. All of this showdown is going to be coming in 1 month. And so that puts a time constraint on what Trump has to plan militarily in Iran. Iran says this is not going to be over in 1 month. This is for us an existential fight. We are not going to stop attacking Israel and other American military bases until these bases are removed from the Middle East and the United States leaves us alone. So this is what it's really all about. It was always about oil, but you're not going to have Trump says come out to the public and say, well, we're bombing Iran in order to cause a regime change to impose a regime very much like we did Boris Yeltsin in Russia, a regime loyal to the United States, not to Iran, a regime that will not insist on Iranian sovereignty, but will follow U.S. policy, just like so far we've been able to do so successfully in Venezuela. So it's all
Michael,
about
Michael, I just wanted to ask you, because I highly recommend your article to our viewers and listeners, but you also raised the specter that this is actually the potentially the beginning of World War III. Could you talk about that as well?
Well, it's World War III because it involves all other countries. So in the fight in Syria, the fight in Gaza has been considered fairly localized. But because the oil trade affects every country. It's worldwide in its implications. And what is happening is that other countries are confronted by an economically aggressive United States. And basically, the United States explained last December in its national security study that American security depends on the ability to deny other countries the sovereignty. We feel insecure if other countries have the sovereignty to act as they wish, which may be against U.S. interests. And now that the United States is no longer an industrial power, now that we've deindustrialized and moved our industry to Asia, we've offshored it, now that we no longer have the financial power that we had before, the whole world order that we created in 1945 under the United Nations, the IMF, and the World Bank no longer serves American interests. Now we have only one way of influencing other countries, and that's our ability to create chaos in other countries if they do not give special givebacks to the United States by joining our attack, our isolation of Russia, China, Iran, Venezuela, and any other country that does not follow a U.S. policy. So the effect of all of this is to, instead of isolating these designated enemies of the United States, Trump's policy is isolating the United States from itself. It's forcing other countries to say, if the basic principle of international law ever since 1648, all the way to the United Nations Charter in 1945, was every country has national sovereignty. It's against international law to interfere with other countries' internal politics and their overall diplomacy. And it's against the international laws of war to make an unprovoked attack on other countries. It's against the international laws of war to focus on civilians. But the U.S. military policy, as we've seen in Iran, and as we've seen in Gaza, and we've seen in Syria, is, and as we've seen in Ukraine, is to focus the military attack on civilians, not military bases, because the Americans think that if you hurt another country enough, they will be so upset, they will overthrow the existing regime change, and they'll say, we don't want to have our girls' schools bombed anymore. We're willing to overthrow the government and put a pro-U.S. government there so that then the United States won't bomb us anymore. Well, that's a crazy idea. It didn't work for England when it was bombing German cities. That just reinforced the German opposition. And when Germany bombed London, it didn't just make London say, well, we're going to just surrender to prevent the V2s from landing here. It galvanized British opposition. Same thing in Iran, that instead of the attack on Iran leading to a regime change, especially now that Iran turned off the internet and the Starlink, that the U.S. had been coordinating a kind of Iranian Maidan political demonstration, the Iranian people overwhelmingly supported the existing government. And that's what any society under attack would do. When you're under attack, you support the government, even if you don't like many of the government's policies, because you don't want to lose national sovereignty. So this is World War III, because the choice is, what kind of a world are we going to have? Will it be the kind of world that was designed in 1945 that is multipolar? Every country is a sovereign country. There's the United States claimed not to have any special power, but it was for free trade then, when no other country was able to compete with American industry, and no other country had the financial resources to be stronger than the United States. And they all needed U.S. financial support, U.S. Military support at that time, and U.S. Economic support. That world is all over now. So the question is whether the world is going to say, we're going to accept President Trump's suggestion that his Board of Peace under U.S. control and his personal control is going to determine world economic policy, or we're going to insist that we, the global majority, create the kind of world that civilization's been moving towards for the last four centuries. Are we going to surrender to the United States, or are we going to say, well, I think it's time to decouple from the United States and de-dollarize? Well, one of the reasons that America has found it so urgent to bomb Iran was that Iran was not pricing its oil in dollars. It was because it was selling to China, it was dealing with Chinese currency. Same thing with Venezuela. Venezuela had announced that it was going to stop pricing its oil in dollars. It was going to price in foreign currencies, and specifically the Chinese currency. Same thing with Russia. Since the Europeans confiscated the $300 billion of Russian savings in Belgium, Russia said, well, obviously, we can't have any of our international transactions in dollars anymore. We're having it in other currencies than dollars. So the United States was faced with a substantial portion of the world export oil trade not being in dollars anymore. And this means that all of the profits from the oil trade were going to move, instead of being recycled to the United States, largely to fund America's military spending abroad in the 800 military bases that it has. The United States will not have the balance of payments inflows from oil to enable it to finance its international military diplomacy and political diplomacy and all of the effects that it has. The private sector is much more in balance than the military spending. And my book, Super Imperialism, explained how military spending was entirely responsible for the whole U.S. balance of payments deficit, the drain of gold from the 1950s to the 1960s into the 1970s. And it's still a major drain on the U.S. balance of payments.
Michael Hudson,
this is at stake.
We want to thank you for being with us. Economist will link to your new article, The U.S.-Israeli Attack Was to Prevent Peace, Not to Advance It. Michael Hudson is president of the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trends, distinguished research professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. To see part one of our discussion, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
On the unaired part of the interview, I was going to try to excerpt it, but it was almost impossible to do so, and I guess I'm glad I didn't. I think the Iranians said that they'd let any tankers go through that where the transaction is occurring in Chinese yuan, but I only heard it once, and I don't know where. The reporting has been abysmal, seems to me. I've only heard submersible drone mentioned once, and it was by that awful guy on the NewsHour who used to be a columnist at the Times. I guess he got off the plantation too. All right, I do want to get to Ken Silverstein's segment, so I will be excerpting the Beirut's Gemari with Ralph Nader. Already made some statements on that. Greg Palast is working with Tom Hartman, and they have some kind of weird contract you have to sign to use their material. I think you might have to run the whole thing, which I wouldn't want to do. I don't think Weft would want to do it either, 2 hours a day. I have some problems with him. Not on the electoral issues, though. And Palast is working with him on that. But, yeah, that's caveat about the misrepresentation of Nader's role in 2000. Let's get on to contemporary stuff, though it's a historical approach as well. Beirut's Gemari Tabrizi gave a great talk on the campus. He used to be in charge of a unit at the U of I before he went to Princeton. Had irreconcilable differences with the people there. And is now at CUNY in New York City, as will be introduced here perhaps. Out of the studios of WBAI New York City, I think. Or maybe he's got his own home studio, I'm not sure.
Beirut's Gemari Tabrizi is an Iranian-born American historian and sociologist. He is a research fellow at the Center for Place, Culture, and Politics at the CUNY Graduate Center. He was the chair of the Department of Near Eastern Studies and director of the Sharman and Bijan Masavar Rahmani Center for Iran and Persian Gulf Studies at Princeton University. He is the author of 3 books on different aspects and historical context of the Iranian Revolution of 1979 and its aftermath. Welcome to the Ralph Nader Radio Hour. Behrouz Ghamari Tabrizi.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Behrouz. We share a common background with Princeton University. I went to school there and you taught there. In an interview you had recently with Amy Goodman, you said that, "I don't think there's any reason to celebrate the demise of the Iranian leader because it's happening in the hands of what I call the king of genocide and someone in the U.S. who's so deeply in trouble with the American legal system, with the Epstein files. And so, for as many people say that this is an Epstein war, and I think we should not be sort of fools to think that this is, in any shape or form, being done on behalf of the Iranian people. This is done on behalf of American and primarily on behalf of Israeli interests. And I think Americans should ask themselves, quote, why exactly are we attacking Iran without any kind of provocation? This is a war that is not in the interest of the United States, and it only fulfills and realizes the desires of a regime in Israel that is promoting forever wars in the region," unquote. And you talk about the civilian toll and the school in southern Iran with girls being killed at a number of that now is well over 125, 9 to 12-year-old girls being blown up, this by, I believe, an American missile. So with this background, and you've had your degree of suffering under this regime, you were imprisoned early in the years of the Ayatollah-led regime, but with this in the background, tell us how this war could have been avoided.
This war, I disagree with people who say that this is a war of choice. I don't think this is a war of choice. This is a blatant case of illegal war of aggression. And I think we need to be very careful about these terms that we use. This is an illegal war of aggression. There was no reason to launch this war, while actually, according to the foreign minister of Oman, the negotiations were going very well, and Iran had shown tremendous flexibility in trying to accommodate the demands of the United States. And exactly as it happened in last June, in the middle of a very successful process of negotiation, the U.S. and Israel launched this war, which leads me to believe that negotiations basically have been a smokescreen for preparing for an attack on Iran to destabilize the country and to create a situation of chaos in the country, which is actually now is happening. And without any specific reasons that could persuade anyone to, for what reasons are we attacking Iran? In violation of which international rules and regulations and laws Iranian government is at this point? The only countries that I see that in constant violation of international law is the United States and Israel. And frankly, I am speechless, although I'm speaking, but I am speechless that in what universe this war can be justified as a self-defense. You listened to Secretary Rubio's speech in Munich that he laments 400 years of colonial rule being lost to this international law and laws of fighting wars because they want to go back to the way things were in 18th and 19th century. This is a naked expansionist, extortionist administration here, and that's the only reason they have launched this war, and there is absolutely no justification for it.
Let's go into the history of this, because if you listen to the media today, history starts, you know, a few weeks ago. It doesn't start in 1953. Can you tell our listeners the lineage of brutal pressure and violence by the United States on Iran, starting with the overthrow in 1953 of its popularly elected Prime Minister Mossadegh, who wanted to control Iranian oil from foreign interests? Give people the assassinations, the sabotage, the Hussein-backed invasion. Give us the history of this.
Yeah, that's actually my job. I'm retired now from teaching history, but for your sake, Ralph, I would do that in a very, you know, short and brief manner. You know, after the Second World War, ironically, a lot of people around the world who were struggling against the old colonial rule looked at the U.S. as an ally, and they tried to sort of justify their desire for independence and national liberation to American administrations, first, you know, to Truman and then Eisenhower. But the U.S. decided that they are going to support the old colonial world, namely the British Empire and the French empires. and to protect their interests in their colonies and then later in their former colonies. Iran was never colonized officially, formally, but nevertheless, Iran from mid-19th century on was the sphere of influence of many colonial powers, including Russian Empire and the British Empire. Iranian oil was discovered in 1908, and the British forced a contract. Listen to this very carefully. They forced a contract on Iranians that 80% to 85% of the profits from Iranian oil would go to the British oil companies, 50% of which was owned by the British government, and only 15% to 16% of the profit of oil would go to the Iranians. This is a natural source of Iranian wealth that only Iranians could benefit from with only 15%. In 1952, Iranian government led by Mohammad Mossadegh decided to nationalize the oil industry and to renegotiate the oil industry contracts with the British Empire. The British refused. They enforced embargoes, sanctions, if it sounds very familiar, sanctions and embargo against Iran. And Mossadegh actually appealed to the Americans to defend the Iranians' right to manage and own their own oil industry. And of course, you know, during Eisenhower administration, they decided that it's in the interest of the U.S. to side with the British, and the CIA with MI6, they organized a coup in 1953, in the August of 1953, and they overthrew Mohammad Mossadegh, and they executed many people who were supporting him inside the country. They installed the Shah of Iran, which ruled after that for another 25 years. And in the Iranian history courses, this years of 25 years rule is known as the Dark Ages of Tyranny, because then they established a horrendous secret police intelligence services by the help of the Israeli Mossad and the CIA. And many, many, many people were executed under the Shah and imprisoned. And, you know, people wonder about 1979 revolution, why it happened and why did it have such an anti-American undertone in it? Because for Iranians at the time, rising up against the tyranny of the Shah was part of the same struggle against American interests in Iran, because American interest in Iran was to keep this kind of tyrannical rule for different kinds of justification, one of which was to sort of stop and contain the spread of communism in the region and the interest of the Soviet Union. But nevertheless, Iranian revolution, which was an anti-monarchy, anti-Shah revolution, inevitably had an anti-American core because of the U.S. support for the Shah. And of course, after the revolution, a bunch of radical Iranian students took over American embassy, thinking that they wouldn't want to allow history repeat itself, because once the CIA overthrew Mossadegh, the fear was that the U.S. is going to work and organize another coup to topple the revolutionary state. They wanted to create a disruption if there was any kind of project to organize a coup against the post-revolutionary regime. Of course, I believe that was a mistake. They shouldn't have taken over American embassy, but I know what the justification was. And I think that people should understand that it wasn't the work of a bunch of crazy people. They were not crazy. They were thinking about history and the fear of history repeating itself. And then, of course, to contain the Iranian revolution, the Americans, the French, Germans, Soviet Union, they all supported Saddam Hussein to invade Iran. A war of 8 years of war, which caused close to 500,000 people killed and the entire infrastructure of the country in ruins. And there was this joke that when Colin Powell was saying that we know that Saddam Hussein had chemical weapons, one of his advisors, this is a joke, one of his advisors said that, how could you be so sure that Saddam had chemical weapons? Colin Powell said that because we kept the receipts. Because during the war, the U.S. was supplying helicopters and Germans were supplying chemical warfare to chemical weapons to Saddam Hussein to attack Iranians. And Iran survived.
And by the way, just to interrupt, Senator Riegel, who's the chairman of the Senate committee investigating U.S. companies' role in providing the raw materials to Saddam Hussein for developing chemical weapons, criticized these corporations. They did these sales, by the way, with a license from the U.S. government. The raw materials were sent by U.S. companies.
Absolutely. That's why, you know, Colin Powell said we kept the receipts, because they sold these things to Saddam Hussein. And of course, you know, you enter Israel and Israeli interests. For years and years, the Israelis have been assassinating Iranian scientists. They were sabotaging Iranian industries. And actually, the Iranian government showed tremendous restraint in responding to these Israeli provocations because they didn't want to create a situation in which we find ourselves today. But then, you know, at the end of the day, calling Iran the aggressor here, I think it's basically a total ignorance of history and the context in which this war has started.
Well, you know, the U.S. military surrounded Iran in Afghanistan when it was in Afghanistan. It surrounded Iran because of its presence in Iraq and its alliance with Israel. And Iran has been accused repeatedly in the U.S. media by U.S. government officials and Israeli officials as being a chief exporter of terror. Well, they wanted a ring of defense. That's why they allied themselves with Hezbollah, for example. Imagine the shoe being on the other foot. We are like thousands of miles away from our empire plunderers, arguing that it's defending U.S. interests. And for Iran to try to do this, having been violently attacked, undermined, and sabotaged, they call it an exporter of terror.
Your reaction? I want to make one point clear. I mean, all these things is not to suggest that the Iranian government in any form or shape is a democratic and just state. But the question here is about the sovereignty of Iranian state. And the only inheritance of the revolution that was kept, has been kept throughout these 40 odd years, was the question of sovereignty, because that was one of the demands of the revolution. The question of social justice was thrown out of the window after the revolution. The question of civil liberties were thrown out of the window after the revolution. The only thing was left and is left is the Iranian sovereignty. And according to every single intelligence study, what Iranians do outside their borders is a defensive posture. Iran does not have an expansionist agenda. In my book that just came out, The Long War on Iran, I quote Henry Pratt, who was at the Iran desk at the State Department. And he very aptly said that, you know, Iranian government is primarily concerned about economic prosperity and security inside, not dominion abroad. And I believe that the U.S. intelligence services are quite aware of this. And the Iranians' help and, you know, that the support for Assad regime in Syria, for Hezbollah in Lebanon, in Iraq, these are all very justified and for good reason that if we don't do this, then the fight is going to be on Tehran streets. And this is actually what happened.
We're talking with Professor Behrouz Ghamari Tabrizi, retired professor from Princeton University, author of the new book, The Long War on Iran, New Events, Old Questions. When was the last time Iran invaded anybody?
Never invaded any other country. And Iran has always been attacked from the outside forces. Never. There is not even a single case that Iran has attacked any other country, neighboring countries or otherwise.
Now, let's look at Iran from another lens, that of Iranian Americans, the expatriates who are demonstrating in support of what Trump did in toppling the Ayatollah. It is often forgotten how dictatorships are created by outside enemies. We're not foreign to that. Look what we did against immigrants in Minneapolis. It's just a harbinger of more to come. But if you want to destroy the Castro revolution and actually invade it, you're going to create dictatorial conditions under Castro in Cuba. If you want to destroy Iran, you are going to create dictatorial conditions in Iran. So let's explore the point of view of Iranian Americans who want to get rid of the Ayatollah regime, democratize Iran, open it up, and are actually celebrating what terrorist Trump has been doing to Iran in collusion with the Israeli Netanyahu regime.
That's right. You know, for decades after decades, Iran has been under this draconian regime of sanctions led by the U.S. and some other European countries. And I have always argued, and you see that argument in my recent book, that these kind of external pressures create a security apparatus inside the country that moves totally against any possibility of democratization. This is exactly the point, Ralph, you brought up, that sanctions do not bring possibility of democracy. Sanctions, military threats, armed resistance to these regimes from outside only securitizes society. And it also impoverishes the population, a population that has the ability to mobilize itself to create a more vibrant civil society. And it's been doing that in Iran. And a lot of people fail to see how much Iranian civil society have been active and vibrant in the past 30 years or so in creating that space for struggle for social justice and civil liberties. All these external pressures work against that possibility inside the country. Because once people open their mouth to criticize the government, immediately they're understood to be agents of foreign powers. And if the U.S. government or any other government or these Iranian diaspora who are promoting this kind of intervention pay close attention, they realize that all these years, all these decades, these efforts have pushed Iranian society towards a more securitized and tyrannical society rather than helping them to create that space for the growth of civil society.
Well, I think in your book, one of the most illuminating...
Okay, that's Ralph Nader starting another question with Behrouz Ghamari Tabrizi from his Ralph Nader Radio Hour. He was on campus a couple of Thursdays ago. I'll get to the second half hour of that. But I wanted to get on something from the author of Tikkun Olam, a blog, in conversation with my go-to guy, Dennis Bernstein. And we'll go to that right now. Again, we'll get back to Behrouz Ghamari, not from his talk that he gave on campus, but from his interview we heard a part of. And right now, I'm on different media than I usually am. Here's Mr. Silverstein and Mr. Bernstein.
It's been a while, Richard, but you've been very busy at Tikkun Olam dealing with crucial life and death issues. We were just talking about Zionism. I don't know if you heard the end of the conversation, but it seems like in this country, in this culture, people don't really know what Zionism is, has been, or the difference between Zionism and Judaism. And that's become a real problem. Where do you want to start on this? I don't even know where to begin.
Well, I just wrote a blog post about it, so I can raise some of the issues. So historically, since the end of the Holocaust, many American Jews have become Zionist, and especially the communal leadership, the Israel lobby groups like the Anti-Defamation League, American Jewish Committee, most of the synagogues in the United States and other institutions like community centers have adopted Zionism as their sort of religion almost. And as Israel has devolved deeper and deeper into criminality and genocide and apartheid and all sorts of other terrible things, it's created a tension in among American Jews. So you have the rank and file American Jews who don't endorse Zionism. There was a poll that said that actually the majority of Jews do not identify as Zionists. That doesn't mean they're anti-Zionists, as I am, you are, but they're not Zionists, and that's really an astonishing fact that I've been waiting for a poll like that to come out for years, and I think it's very important. So the reason why it is important is that around the world, people, Muslims, people on the left, think that that Zionism and Judaism are the same thing. And Israel itself supports that kind of notion because it claims to represent the entire Jewish people. It doesn't, of course, and the worse things become politically in Israel, the less that's the case. Now, what I believe and what I have strived for over many decades is for American Jews to dissociate themselves from Israel and Zionism. So that the anti-Semitic notion that the crimes of Israel are the crimes of Jews and Judaism is no longer valid. If we don't do that, then we are going to get the kinds of attacks that happened in Michigan at the synagogue there, in which a Lebanese-American drove a truck into a synagogue after his family was murdered in Beirut by Israel. So I don't think that we can blame Muslims and others who are suffering and whose relatives and whose family are being murdered in Gaza and Beirut and in Iran, we can't blame them if they blame Zionists in Israel and outside of Israel for these crimes. So it's really important morally that we not only not take responsibility for Israel, but that we separate ourselves and say we do not identify with this, and we want nothing to do with this as Jews.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, we're speaking with Richard Silverstein. His blog is Tikkun Olam. I think it's T-I-K-U-N-U-N. O-L-A-M, and we're talking about Zionism, which is it's almost a forbidden topic, Richard, and I think it's confused on purpose in public, and yet it is the cause of a great deal of suffering. And as you, just to be clear, this genocide that we have been witnessing in Gaza is generated by highly engaged Zionist Jews, and their cause is to essentially kill Palestine, kill the Palestinians, and create the greater Israel. Do I have that right?
Yes, and one other thing I want to bring up is that the people you're talking about, the Itamar Ben-Gvirs, the Bezalel Smotriches, they are motivated by what I would call a fundamentalist version of Judaism. They consider themselves to be messianists who are seeking, the messianic redemption, which for them means the ultimate destruction of Islam, the destruction of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, its replacement with a holy temple. And they have this ancient sort of Israelite view of holy war against the heathens, and in which the Jews, their version of Judaism, would be triumphant and the age of the Messiah would be upon us. And this is an incredibly dangerous perspective. And it's yet another reason why I, as a Jew, and others really feel it's important that we say, no, this is not Judaism, just as we say that Al-Qaeda is not Islam. The same thing holds true with settlers who claim to be speaking on behalf of Judaism, that we say no to this. And the problem that I have with the leadership of the American Jewish community and those organizations that I mentioned is that they refuse to do that because they are so beholden to Israel that they are refusing to take a moral position on this. And really, I think it bespeaks their bankruptcy, their moral bankruptcy, that they are not willing to see what is going on and to speak out against it.
You know, I remember I was speaking in Oakland, I think, or Berkeley, here in the Bay Area, and the subject was Israel. And I'll never forget, when I showed up, there was a gauntlet of big men lined up all the way on both sides to the entrance to where I was speaking. And they were very close, facing each other. So you had to walk through the gauntlet to get into the event, and then they'd shove leaflets right into you. So you had to make a commitment to get in to the building. But does this sound familiar?
Oh, yeah. There's a real strong strain of violence. Not only violence directed against Palestinians, which of course is true, but also intimidation and violence against Jews that don't hold with their brand of Judaism. They use intimidation. You can see on social media, they dox people. They attempt to get people fired from their jobs. They try to destroy reputations of academics and others. And it's a noxious, really horrible thing. I mean, I've been a victim of this for decades. I remember that in 1985, an Arab American was murdered by a bomb that was set by someone in the JDL in Orange County. And when the Jewish organization that I was a staff member of, New Jewish Agenda, we took out an ad and we, as a memorial to Alex Hodeh, who was murdered. By the way, it was just a film released through that film festival that I'm forgetting the name of in Utah, that film about his murder, we received death threats on the phone, recorded on our answering machine. So this is the kind of anger and hatred that the Connors and the JDL and groups like it. Now, by the way, let's say that the Israeli government is now essentially Kahanist. And, you know, Meir Kahana may be dead, but his disciples are running the asylum in Israel. So it's been really the ascendancy and the victory of Kahana over all of his enemies.
Richard, what's your best understanding about where this might be going, given the Israeli response to the U.S. attack and this massive attack on Lebanon?
Well, I think that it's going to play out over a long period of time, which is not going to play well to Trump, who claims that the war is short, he claims the war is over, he claims that Iran is obliterated. None of this, of course, is true. So the war hasn't subdued Iran. It won't subdue Lebanon either, because both Hezbollah and Iran have a capability of resisting. They're still inflicting damage through drones and missiles on the Gulf states that are the U.S. allies, attacking U.S. bases in those countries, and Iran is still defiant. And Israel and the U.S. cannot subdue those countries. War will not work. And that is the fatal flaw of this strategy. They believe that they can, their combined military might will overwhelm any resistance using this shock and awe kind of treatment. And it just won't work. And it's going to take a while, I think, before that sinks in. Maybe Trump will realize that his approval ratings are going through the floor. And he will have to eventually turn tail and run, declare victory and go home. But he will not get the victory he's anticipating.
Finally, the battle cry is, Israel has the right to exist, and thus it needs to be defended with all means necessary. Is it different than another country? I mean, it is a righteous individual creation, or what is it? What is it?
What is Israel, you're asking, or?
Yeah, I'm asking. I mean, how do you, is it, it's a legitimate state, thus it, you know, it has its representation.
Well, Israel is a unique thing. It's a religious state. It calls itself a Jewish and democratic state. It's actually neither, especially not a democracy. But it claims that it is a state of the Jewish people. The problem with that is that it is a nation, founded based on an ideology. And in my opinion, religions and nationalism are in conflict with each other, or should be in conflict with each other. And so when you mix the two, when you mix politics with a religion, you get this really toxic, poisonous interaction. And that's exactly what's happened in Israel. Religion has taken over state, and it's become a nation of fanatics and messianists and people who are prepared for holy war, and a nation that is a garrison state and whose existence is based on perpetual conflict. Now, that is not the Judaism that I represent, and that's not the Judaism I want to have anything to do with. So that's the problem that Israel faces in terms of its definition of itself.
Finally, your thoughts on what you'd like to see happen at this point, given the current situation. Clearly, there needs to be some kind of ceasefire. But again, is there any recovering from what Israel is doing, what they did to Gaza, and now what they're doing to Lebanon? It seems like they really want to destroy a good part of the country.
Yeah, I mean, they threatened to do to Beirut what they did to Gaza. They dropped leaflets all over Beirut and told people they had to overthrow Hezbollah, and if they didn't, Beirut would be turned into a zone of total devastation, which, of course, Israel cannot accomplish.
Okay. flashpoints from Tuesday. That's Richard Silverstein. His blog is Tikkun Olam, Repairing the World. And thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting community media. Opinions are those of the speakers, of course. We'll get back to Behrouz Ghamari Tabrizi tomorrow at 5 o'clock or so. And well, here's another underwriting announcement, and we'll go right into Radio Free Labor. Fired up, I guess.
Support for WEFT Radio comes from Urbana Arts and Culture, providing resources such as arts grants, artist opportunities, events, and other arts and culture programming. Since 2008, the program